Good evening, anarchists everywhere, and welcome to tonight's Anarchism in the UK. I'm Ian Bone. Tonight's guest is Sandy Hale. Welcome, Sandy.
Cheers. Thanks for having us.
Sandy's a member of the newly formed Liberty and Solidarity organisation, but first things first, how did you first get involved in politics, Sandy?
Well, I come from a solidly Labour family, and on top of that, there was always sort of semi-political material around the house, like Greenpeace action updates and various kind of just straightforward human rights stuff like amnesty. So I was always reading that as a kid, and I quickly got to the conclusion there's some very, very bad things going on in the world. I think one of the earliest things I remember was reading about the bombing of Rainbow Warrior, the Greenpeace ship, by the French Secret Service, and being very upset and angry about that. And then I suppose it was the Sunday supplements on Reclaim the Streets and the May Day riots.
Right.
And I felt for the first time there was something that was open enough and straightforward enough. I was talking about when I'm 14 here, that I could actually go and just see, you know, there's an event, I could go to it, I could see what radical politics was.
Were you living in London then? Or
yes, I was, yeah, from Kilburn in northwest London. And at 16, I finally made the jump from going to the occasional protest. I think the first thing I ever went on was an anti-privatisation protest for the rail, because this was after Hatfield, and I was just very directly just hugely angry. These people had made a little money by cutting corners on the railways, people being paid less to do it, and now, you know, people were dying because of privatisation. At this point, I thought the Labour Party was essentially a good thing, but had been hijacked, and with a little bit of pressure...
Could get it back.
Yeah, actually, funnily enough, I was always in favour of direct action, so I was a direct action old Labourite. So for a little bit of direct action, such as, you know, occupying perhaps privatisation conferences, we could get the Labour Party back on track. I didn't even want to change in the leaders of the Labour Party. I thought they were OK because they'd been elected. But I just wanted to get it back to nationalisation. But it was at 16.
These are the true life confessions of Sandy Hale. Anarchists all over the country recording every minute of this.
I bear in mind, I was a teenager, and I didn't define myself as an anarchist until I was 19. So,
and did you, between identifying yourself as an anarchist and from the Labour Party, did you get attracted to any of the lefty organisations, or did you bypass them?
Well, this is the thing. At 16, I finally made the jump and I went on a May Day demonstration. And the trouble with anarchists then and the trouble with anarchists now is they were all over the place, but there was no way of approaching them. So the group that did approach me were a small Trotskyist youth group. They didn't even tell you they were Trotskyists, called Revolution. And I was just associated with them on and off for about 3 years. There was no membership or anything. They just organised events for us to come to. It was all young people, apart from a tiny clique of people who were in workers' power. So we kind of, our ideas were like legalise all drugs, and their ideas were support Saddam Hussein. So it was a bit of an interesting marriage of inconvenience.
But presumably you had some fun. The Revolution lot look as though they might have had a
bit of fun. Yeah, well, they picked up a young following by aping kind of non-violent direct action tactics. So people climbed up, what's that recreated ship on the South Bank, not the Mary Celeste, that disappeared, Francis Drake's
Golden.
Yeah, so they two 13 year olds climbed to the top of the rigging and just dropped a huge red banner saying something like communism or something like that
on the Golden Hind.
So
when did you come across sort of specifically anarchist politics, or what did you read? Did you come across any anarchist writings or papers? Or?
My political education actually comes from, and this is probably why I'm so messed up, internet bulletin boards. So it was mostly seeing anarchist debate with other socialists that made me realise anarchism was a more serious tendency than just a simple rejection, which is what it appeared to be. Just as in no voting, no leaders, no this, no that. It seemed to be kind of more of a tendency of criticism. But it was on the internet I saw people arguing it through. But really, the main time I read... Well, I would have just been vaguely political, except for a very large incident in my life, which happened when I was 18, which is the sixth form college I was at. An ex-student got killed in Palestine, Tom Herndl.
Yeah.
And I was... I contacted the International Solidarity Movement, which is a human rights direct action group that he was working with, which runs on vaguely anarchist principles, like direct democracy. I contacted them to come in and do a talk, and they actually had someone who was with Tom when he died, so it was very moving. The whole school was in there. And after that, I decided I would go to Palestine. But as I say, like this was... I was not massively political. And it was in Palestine. So I went to Palestine at 18, a couple of weeks after finishing my A-levels.
Crikey.
And it was there that Well, I saw, direct democracy and making consensus decisions, which were kind of the decisions on, like, you know, do we walk towards the live fire with our hands up, or do we turn around and walk in the other direction? Blah, blah, blah. So it threw questions of democracy and decision making into high relief. Mm. And my solace there, because it was populated by a lot of very, very self-sacrificing American kind of ultra liberals, basically pacifists, consensus decision making people. My refuge was my affinity group. It was mostly made up of someone who shared, people who shared my sense of humour and could take a step back and kind of see, you know, that these situations do actually throw up some funny stuff, I'm afraid to say. And they were Irish, and they came from a group called the Worker Solidarity Movement.
Right, yeah.
And so whilst we were walking along the route of the apartheid wall in the West Bank for 2 weeks and doing direct actions along the way, getting tear gassed and rubber bullets and whatnot, I got to have lots of conversations about anarchism with them. And we both left thinking we hadn't convinced each other of anything, but they must have, sown the seeds, because it wasn't long after that. When I got back, having been involved in such a heavy situation, I wanted to be involved in an active movement, and anarchism was the only one which seemed to be taking action.
Yeah.
So the first thing I was involved in when I got back was stuff like social centres. The Womble social centres had a great influence on me. And and that was that, basically. After that, I decided to call myself an anarchist. And, that was it.
I mean, one of the hard things to do when you're returning from Palestine is just to find a way into the anarchist movement, isn't it? Mm. It's not like you can go somewhere, and you mentioned the socialists in there, but the anarchist movement's always been really bad. It's sort of making it easy for people to find out more, or join something, to find out what's going on.
Absolutely. I mean, the social centres were very interesting, because you'd walk in and you'd immediately get it. They've taken over this building, they've rented this building, so the cases are some social centres, and it's an open community resource. And they hope that by providing this resource, people are going to start taking responsibility for their own lives, start questioning capitalism and paying for things and all this other stuff. But if you go in and you want to find out more about anarchism or more about the group behind it, you don't get to. I mean, it's easier to actually become involved in helping a social centre in a day-to-day way than actually learn anything of the reasons behind it.
Yeah.
So I was washing dishes in the social centre before I managed to even find someone who would talk to me about anarchism, which is what I really wanted to know.
Yeah, yeah.
I had to really, really create my involvement in anarchism. I wrote to one of the major anarchist organisations, and typically for writing to a major anarchist organisation, it took them several months to reply.
Funny, I had a very similar experience when I first did the same in the early 1960s. I wrote a letter to Freedom asking them about becoming an anarchist, and I had a letter back about 9 months later.
Yeah, what did it say?
Nothing, it's just an incomprehensible copy of Anarchy magazine, just unreadable to a 14-year-old. So you must have been pretty dissatisfied with all the existing national anarchist organisations, and they didn't seem to reach out to you or offer what you were looking for?
No, I mean, it was a learning process. I was in the Anarchist Federation for a while, for about 2 years. And I just joined that because, you know, I said, I'm an anarchist now, I should be in an organisation. But I didn't really know much about the different tendencies, like, say, insurrectionism and syndicalism and platformism and all these different things. But I slowly picked it up. I think the reason that LNS came together was there were a number of...
Tell us what LNS is.
The reason that my organisation, Liberty and Solidarity, which is about 6 months old now, is the newest anarchist organisation. The reason it came together was the experience of anarchists in the radical trade union, the IWW, which is a syndicalist trade union, and the decision-making process. The decision-making process is open, obvious, and clear. It's a democracy, straightforward democracy. There's no qualms about it being democracy, because it's not an explicitly anarchist organisation. Despite that, it's mostly anarchists. And so we had this experience of making these quick decisions about big things, you know, about people's lives. You know, do they strike? Do they risk their job? Or do they not? Do they take direct action? Or do they go through the courts? And we made those decisions democratically, and there were minorities, and they lost those votes. They could appeal and challenge them, sure, but if you lost, you had to like it or lump it. Mm. If you disliked it so much, there would be some kind of reconciliation. There would be some appeal process. But most of the time, people accepted. In fact, all of the time I've been in the WOBS, which is 2 or 3 years, people have accepted losing things. It's never been more important to them to have their minority opinion taken than it has for the organisation to continue to be useful to working class people.
Yeah.
So we had this experience, this decision-making, this snappy, fast decision-making. And we wanted to see it replicated in a specifically anarchist group, you know. And so that's why we formed LNS.
So who formed LNS with you?
The meeting came about with me and the people I've been working with for about 3 years, which is basically, I don't know, the younger element, perhaps, who come from Reading, some people from Birmingham who I knew through the IWW, and my comrades in London. And we met up with a guy called Nick from the platformist organisation in Scotland called Praxis, which has now actually become Liberty and Solidarity in Scotland. We've merged. And talked it through. And we set up Liberty and Solidarity with the express aim that we'd have this decision-making process and everything would flow from there. So we didn't start with a main political objective or to have a policy on immigration or have a policy on policing. First things first was that we'd have a policy on making policies so we could actually do it and say, the organisation has said this, not we think this, or some people in this organisation think this, but this is our line and this is how we're going to organise. So the public can see it and understand what we're saying and say that this is definitely what we're going to do. Which is why we don't have a mass of information on our website. We only have stuff that we're involved in.
Yeah, I look at your website today. I noticed that the word anarchist only crops up a couple of times. Is that a conscious decision not to plug the word anarchist, even though people know you are anarchist? Is that a conscious decision you've taken?
Yes, I think it is. I originally argued that it shouldn't pop up at all, but I think people are going to identify you as anarchist anyway because the politics speak for themselves. I mean, obviously, we're not talking about running in elections. Obviously, we're talking about direct democracy and community control and worker control of industry. It's obviously anarchism, but people are more likely to have an aversion. And we're talking about the millions who aren't part of the 0.001% of anarchists to the word anarchism, to the word anarchy. And remember that the dictionary definition of anarchy is two definitions, and one of them says chaos and disorder. So I think it's not necessarily a beneficial relationship. So, yeah, we're good. I think the politics will speak for themselves. And our involvement in the rest of the anarchist movement through just about everything that's going, we're not hostile to anything really, speaks for itself as well. I mean, anarchists are going to know we're anarchists, and the general public will find out we're anarchists through our politics.
Yeah. I've read the two bits on industry and community on the website, and on the community side, it seems that your main thrust is the formation of residents' associations, encouraging people to form residents, and really sort of contest control of local communities and estates with the council, even mentioning onto a position of dual power, the residents run the estates and the services. How do you see that developing?
Well, I see it as a pragmatic thing, because a revolution is not really a single event, not a successful one anyway, not a successful revolution. It's not a sudden breakout. It's a long-term building up of class power to the point where you can have that final push, and hopefully it'll be as peaceful as possible. But the only way that you're going to build up that power is finding ways for people to support themselves as working class people within the system that we have, and dual power is the way to do it. So by residents' associations taking control of their areas, but not taking complete control and actually forcing the state out, and you have the Republic of Croydon or something like that, you have just a very strong residents' association movement which stops estates from being closed, it gets repairs done, that makes sure that, you know, people drive safely and all these other boring things that don't sound very revolutionary at all. When you have the then you can build up power in the rest of the areas. You build up power in industry until you go, oh, hang on a minute, we're operating at a position of dual power and we don't need to anymore because we have effective control over industry and the communities. I also think that if we're honest, then we think, you know, at worst, nothing's going to happen except we set up these bodies and there's not going to be a revolution or anything like that. Setting up these bodies is beneficial to people's day-to-day lives.
How do you see the difference between your involvement in local community stuff and residents and, say, sort of Lib Dems dog shit, you know, community politics?
Well, the Lib Dems are adopting something which is a genuine concern. Community politics is something which is going to bring people in, it is going to empower people, and that's why they've done it. But the Lib Dems are doing it to empower their party to take part in an undemocratic system, which is the parliamentary democracy. And the Lib Dems have a number of kind of liberal ideas of reforming it, but essentially they want their party to be elected and people will do what they say. Now, obviously, we don't want anything to go past the original residents' forums, so they take control. They don't take control and anoint a Lib Dem councillor or anoint a Lib Dem MP. They take control and run it themselves.
some people might see some similarities between community politics and what the IWCA has been doing and talking about. Was there a distinction between your approach to community politics and the IWCA's, or were you pretty similar?
Actually, no, there isn't. The other main contributory factor to the formation of Liberty and Solidarity was a number of people who used to be in the IWCA. Who are in this organisation now. And the IWCA is technically fine. We don't agree with their running of councillors, but we know why they do it. I think I'll give an example, basically. I worked for a number of months in Hackney, the occupation of Tony's Cafe, this guy who tried to buy his cafe off the council. The councillor basically said, no, we don't want your money. We want to sell it to an international property developer and get rid of your poxy working class cafe because it's not with the keeping of the area we want. And the community occupied it, and there was this huge community campaign, and it was coordinated by Hackney Independent, who were originally a branch of the IWCA. And they went for the standard IWCA thing is, right, we've got this whole community upsurge, now we'll run a councillor, we'll turn that into having a councillor. And it's not that we want council power, it's that we'll use this councillor to continue to empower the community, to divert funds, to be a thorn in the side of the council, la la la. Very good argument, except they lost by a hair, but they lost. And so all of the power, all of the feeling that had been built up in that community was dissipated like that because they said, right, this is what you do, you have this councillor, and there's every chance you might lose. But so in my opinion, I think you should stick with just empowering the community.
Yeah, but what if a resident, you set up a residence, or the residents have got a residence association, and the residents association decides we want to stand for the council, and suppose they won?
I think we'd continue to be part of it, and a critical tendency, basically. Yeah. I wouldn't stop them from doing it. No. By the way, I'd just like to say, I'm speaking for myself today. I haven't been mandated by Liberty and Solidarity.
For someone who's very keen on mandated, you should have got your mandate sorted out. Let's move on. You've mentioned the Wobblies in passing, and let's move on to the IWW, because you remember the IWW.
Yes, I am.
Back a bit, because we may have some people who don't know what the IWW is or the Wobblies is. Right. Could you give us a sort of minute intro to the IWW?
Yeah, for someone who's so fervently for the IWW, I'm actually uncharacteristically unsure on their original history, but I can say they were founded in 1910 in America. They're a syndicalist union, which means that they want everybody, all workers, in what they call the one big union. So not just all grades within a workplace, like the RMT has cleaners to tube drivers on the trains, but all workers in all workplaces in one union. And the idea being that they can then launch a revolutionary general strike and take over society. And the working class would run it via the structures set up by the union. This movement in America was very, very, very successful, and it was promptly crushed, like all trade unions were, in the early 20th century by force, with lots of massacres and lots of machine guns and lots of soldiers. It then had a rebirth in the 60s, mostly because everything had a rebirth in the 60s. It was just a radical time.
Nothing wrong with a bit of rebirthing, comrades.
No. And it's slowly built up again until it became an actually serious contender about 10 years ago in America, especially with something like, they just picked Starbucks and went, this is the one place that no one can unionise because it just says no unions, absolutely not, no unions at all. And they unionised it, and you now have a Starbucks union. And this was a brilliant, in my opinion, this is a brilliant publicity stunt. It made people go like, fucking hell, you can unionise anything. And that was the start of the IWW's quite rapid growth in America, and inspired growth in this country as well. And the idea of the IWW is this one big union for all workers, and to work across all industries and not have different earning abilities and different crafts opposed to each other. So you don't have someone saying, well, he only sweeps the roads and I'm a carpenter, so basically our interests aren't common. And it says, no, they are. You're both workers, you both work for a wage, and you're both entitled to far more than what that wage is. You're entitled to everything you create. And that's the main basic, very, very, very basic communist politics of the IWW.
So in this country, then, you belong to the IWW, but you'd also belong to a regular trade union as well, if you wanted, sort of membership.
Yeah.
And you'd also belong, people in Liberty and Solidarity would also be in the IWW if they wanted to be, yeah.
Yes, we fully endorse the WOBS. It's part of the IWW. It's part of our industrial strategy. And there's only a couple of people in LNS who haven't joined yet, but will do. We push a line which the British IWW is largely taking, which is that you do, you join both unions. You join the main workplace one, and then you join the IWW. Now, we know from the experience of the main trade unions that they will sell you out, and sometimes they'll be militant when they need to attract members or look militant, but their interest isn't actually in winning every strike. Their interest isn't actually in gaining class power. So in that situation, what's beautiful about the IWW is we're not just a syndicalist idea. Like, we're not just a nice idea. We are actually a registered trade union, so we can represent you. And this has happened. An R&T member was sacked in Leicester. And the main problem was that he was the reason he was sacked was he was sacked by a higher up who was in the RMT as well. So the union couldn't rush to defend him because there was a slightly higher ranking RMT member. So this position, I mean, it was a messy situation. I'm not saying it was good in any way, shape or form, but the IWW could represent him.
Yeah.
We'll act as, hopefully, pressure on the mainstream trade unions so that, for instance, if Unison doesn't want to fight the NHS cuts, and we do, they might be forced to do so. Because if people start saying, look, well, I'm taking action in the IWW, they can legally protect me, and I want to take action against privatisation and cuts.
But you also encourage people to become shop stewards in the regular trade unions.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I think that we're the only anarchist group which puts no provisos on trade unions and says, you know, as in they're not revolutionary or they mediate capital, which both of which are true. But we're the only group that says, despite all this, join them, because if they're not
Well, that's right. That is a distinction between yourself and the other anarchist groups. Yeah, traditional line.
The experience of the last 50 or 30 years, roughly. You had quite a few anarchists saying, like, it's the trade unions that stopped the revolution from happening. Because every time we get close to this burgeoning class power, like we did in the late 70s, which in my opinion was the closest Britain came to a proper kickoff. The unions sell us all out, and so they said, well, you know, with the collapse of the unions, thank God for that, because now an unmediated war between the employer and the worker, with the union not there to sell them out and represent them, they'll see their class interests far more clearly, and we'll have a proper class struggle. And the exact opposite has happened. We've seen a complete destruction of class consciousness, complete destruction of any ability to fight back in non-unionised sectors. And that's it, basically. So, I mean, even those criticisms sounded pretty fair at the time in the 70s and 80s with all the sellouts and the bureaucracy and the unions. Without them, the class struggle has gone backwards. Yeah. So we are ringingly endorse getting involved in trade unions.
Let's move on to something else you're involved in, which is the London Coalition Against Poverty. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, LCAP is LCAP was set up by a number of people, but two of them would later go on to become Liberty and Solidarity members. So we've been involved as part of other people since the beginning of the London Coalition Against Poverty. The idea of the London Coalition Against Poverty is taken from the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty in Canada, which is that you fight for everything you're due under the legal, you know, welfare system, but you do it with para-parliamentarian methods such as direct action, sit-ins in offices, occupations, and generally haranguing the council until they give people what they're due. And after a certain point, when what people are due under the welfare system isn't enough, we'll take it anyway, such as rehousing people in empty blocks and things like that. The Ontario Coalition Against Poverty's most genius thing was to get a number of sympathetic doctors to designate poverty as a special dietary requirement.
Oh, really?
So that thousands and thousands and thousands of people had the amount of money they got for food on the dole in Canada upped under the special dietary
requirement. Well, you can get prescribed food on the NHS.
So the idea for LCAP is to encourage people to take direct action around poverty. And I think the advantage of this is that, one, it explains that poverty exists, which puts class on a material backing rather than a cultural one. People understand that, you know, at the end of the day, there's a rich and a poor. It's not just, you know, do you go to football? Do you prefer beer or wine? There's a rich and a poor, and millions of people are actually being really seriously fucked over.
And what is LCAP actually doing in practice? And what campaigns
in practice,
are they?
The main thing we're doing at the moment is around housing. And we're about to launch a campaign which is going to go to every single borough. And we're going to be doing actions against the process of gatekeeping. Gatekeeping is the way that councils use what are known as the five tests. The five tests of homelessness, which award you your ranking on how quickly you need a house. How they use them to not house people, basically, to keep them staying on friends' sofas or even on the streets. And those are people come to us and say, this is my situation. and we say, right, are you willing to fight back? Are you willing to take direct action? Are you willing to work with us, and you're going to lead your campaign for housing? And if they say yes, then we'll take action and we help them out. We also end up doing very straightforward stuff, like just going to an office and explaining stuff because, you know, they don't speak good English or something like that. But so we're going to go to every borough and we're going to do actions around this gatekeeping process. I'm going to try and work out which London borough is the worst for not housing people, which probably turned out to be Kensington and Chelsea. And yeah, and do some actions around that. So councils beware.
Right, we've got about 5 minutes left. How do you see politics at the moment? Are you optimistic? I mean, the recession's obviously going to bite in the next few months. Yeah. And we've seen sort of the effects of the recession elsewhere in Europe, both in Greece but recently in Bulgaria, Latvia, Lithuania.
Iceland,
indeed.
But previously,
you sort of gave a fairly gloomy prognosis about the class struggle and about people's capability. Do you see optimistic signs of sort of fight back coming?
Yeah, I do.
Tell us some of them then.
Well, I think people are losing. Well, we've had social peace for a long time, and the fact is that those millions of people might be suffering serious poverty, but it was sidelined. People didn't see it. You know, you didn't have people losing their jobs. And now this, you know, they can't even hide it. They haven't even tried to put a brave face on the fact that capitalism is completely f***ed up. You know, you've got the IMF saying, like, this is the worst recession since the 1930s. You know, people are questioning capitalism openly from the mainstream media. Now, what this means is that half the argument's been made for us. We don't have to tell people that capitalism doesn't work. It's obvious. What we get on with now is building permanent organisations of solidarity in community and industry, which can fight against the inevitable impoverishment of most people. And that's why we formed LNS, really, to put forward standing organisations, permanent ones, which can, you know, move with the crisis and fight back, rather than kind of just ad hoc protests or actions around the crisis, but ones which are always going to be there, because with the influence of syndicalism, we believe in building directly democratic organisations in the here and now, so that we can run society democratically in the future. And the effect of the crisis is going to be that for the first time, that idea is actually going to be quite appealing to a majority of people all over the world.
You've also been involved, we've only got a couple of minutes, in attempts to sort of revive the anarchist movement in London. Well, to revive it, to give at least a semblance of coherence and meetings and so on. Do you think that's something that's going to pan out, or are we going to go back to the usual, a couple of meetings and nothing happens?
I think there's nothing to be gained from saying that it won't, because, you know, you don't get a prize for saying I told you so. You know, it'd be nice if you did and, you know, Bakunin came down from the sky and said, yes, you know what, you said it was and you're right. You don't, you get no points for that. So I think it will pan out. I think either people will get so frustrated with not making decisions that they join an organisation which does, hint, hint, or their form of organisation, their very ad hoc kind of let's just get doing stuff does work. I mean, it has had some successes in the past. RTS, even though RTS was secretly run by the organising committee every time, still, they attracted thousands of people to take really, really good and inspiring direct action against capitalism. So either it doesn't work and people start, you know, looking for a proper decision-making process, or it does work and we get loads more attention anyway. So I think it's win-win and there's nothing to be gained sitting on the outside.
Yeah, I thought to ask you a couple of last questions. If people wanted to join this organisation, which is standing there ready to fight back, how do they get in touch with LNS?
They would go to www.libertyandsolidarity.org.
Yeah, and LCAP, how would...
They'd go to www.lcap.org.
Right. Okay, thanks a lot, Sandy. Thanks for giving the Liberty and Solidarity. It's plug on the radio, and thanks a lot for... And be back again next week with another... programme in Anarchism in the UK.